Welcome to Rumike Talks podcast. I'm your host, Konstantin Starodetsky. This is a space where I interview professionals from the entertainment industry and discuss popular film-related topics with my co-host
and producing partner, Rumena Dinevska. Our goal is to help and motivate aspiring filmmakers to get their films made.
Enjoy. All right, guys, welcome to the Rumike Talks podcast. And today we have a guest, Jeremy Harris, a cinematographer. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, man. This is a super honor of mine, man. You're an amazing human being, man. I love you so much, and that you asked me to be here. It's quite special.
Where are you calling from right now?
From Washington, D.C., you know, born and raised, home.
Nice. Is it hot? Or, like, right now I'm sitting in California sweating, wiping off my forehead.
Oh yeah. I have the air conditioning blasting right now in the house because it's really, 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 really hot here, and it's so humid here. It's something like we've never felt here before, man, and it's, you know, it's a doozy.
All right, so let's dive in into today's conversation. I want to know a little bit more about young Jeremy. What happened? When was the moment when you decided to pursue a career in filmmaking?
Young Jeremy, he's mostly interested in painting and in watching films. My mother was a huge influence on the film side of it. My brother was an even bigger inspiration on the painting side of it. But it wasn't until maybe a few years before actually you and I had met that I wanted to find a way to get back to those painting roots. But, you know, after not painting for a long, long time, you kind of got to work your way back in, and the flow of it just didn't feel the same. And I felt like maybe it was another way or another medium to express that. And as always, kind of followed my brother into photography a little bit. But, you know, that I felt like that wasn't exactly a pinpoint on it, and then following which could be, you know, another brother of mine, a close friend of ours, Joseph, who's a director, into film school, was the moment I realized that cinematography was that way of being able to express myself in that painterly fashion, in that manner. So it took me a little bit longer in life. I think that was just more of a, I would chalk it up to say, more of a time of learning and understanding and appreciating films and filmmaking before I was able to actually step foot in that world and be able to express myself in that manner.
Were there any particular cinematographers or movies that inspired you when you were young, or when you decided to become a cinematographer around that time?
Yeah, I would say seeing Spike Lee and hearing him speak about his cinematographer, Ernest Dickerson, and it really gave me insight that there was a human being behind that. And, you know, it was great to see someone that, you know, looked like Spike Lee or looked like me. And the older I got and the more I delved into the true understanding of it and the people around it, I feel as though, especially being from Washington, D.C., and hearing about this young guy that went to Howard University, that he's doing cinematography and really, you know, growing with it was Bradford Young. You know, hear his name in the streets of D.C. and see some of his films that he was putting out because he went to Howard University, which is a very, very big school here, and very, very prestigious school for filmmaking. Like, some of the top, you know, filmmakers and actors that you know all went to that school. I wish, you know, I was cool enough to had went to that school or known enough by that time, but, you know. But Bradford Young, and I would also say I was a big fan of Steve McQueen's work. So his cinematographer, Sean Bobbitt, was a huge inspiration to me because I needed something to ground me in it, because I thought, you know, so big of the world of cinematography and so intimidated by it. But watching Sean Bobbitt's work and watching him talk about it and listening to his background and where he came from and how it was so similar to mine, made me feel like I was able to, you know, maybe I could miss a few things in understanding lighting here or not be as confident here or there in this part of camera. But if you went at it with, you know, your heart and you were able to just understand, you know, the way the world works, the way that what the sun gives you, what the night gives you, you know, or anything in that matter, and you're able to tell your story, you know, it doesn't really matter the apparatus. It just means, you know, to use your brain and your heart in it. So I kind of took to those two guys first, and I would, you know, obviously I would be remiss without mentioning Roger Deakins. I think that's kind of like, you know, that's like speaking about Michael Jordan playing basketball. You know, you have to say Roger Deakins. So yeah, he was an enormous, you know, inspiration to me. Yeah.
When was the first time that you made a movie? It could be like something very simple, or maybe it was at film school. What was your first experience of actually filming with the camera?
I was in undergraduate school. I was, you know, finally, it took me to my junior year of college to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do. So mm-hmm. I found that direction. I chose my major. It was communication arts, and there was a class of you know, basically teaching me how to run a TV studio, or even, you know, the jobs on a sitcom show. And, you know, mm-hmm. each and every day, everyone would learn a bit of, you know, the technical director, the camera person, the director, the assistant, you know, all those jobs each and every day. And, yeah, that was one of my first moments of being behind the camera. One of my close friends who I actually played on the football team with at that school, he wrote a nice, cool little sitcom. And we went in there and we shot it. And we did a simple, like, three camera setup, like it was a full on, you know, TV studio. And, you know, the first time I did it, I was the technical director because I wanted to really learn it. At that point in time, I really didn't have I wasn't really fascinated with cameras like I am now. It's really intimidating, even the one at the studio, even with the time that we got to learn around it. But, you know, after long, and when that moment in time came up for us to actually, you know, roll cameras for the first time and actually have it be, you know, a production for that very first time in my life, you know, I was pretty nervous. But, you know, when we got to going, I actually ended up being the camera operator on the show, the main camera operator on the show. And that was kind of like the first time I really picked up a camera and took part, you know, in a production like that. I mean, when I was a kid, I'd always mess around with my brother's 35 millimeter photography cameras. I was never really a photograph or photography person. I was always a sketcher and a painter growing up. So it started to kick in, yeah, around that time in college. My mother was a television broadcast editor for a very long time. But even that would kind of, you know, would scare me out of it, because when I would go to the studios, I would see the guys and the women all, you know, moving the cameras around and all. It was so intimidating. You know, but shit. Once I got into college and, you know, took those courses and, you know, utilizing the old football attitude that you kind of just got to go into it, you know, I was able to just hop on that camera and you know, if I felt a different synergy at that moment in time. So I guess, you know, after a while, you know, so a few years later, it would become, you know, something I would fall in love with.
Nice. So what are the top mm-hmm. lessons that you learned from studying filmmaking? Studying media, studying communications.
I think with me, just overall in life, I've been a very instinctive person. And for me, when it comes to filmmaking, you can always either second guess or double think or overthink in general. And in a lot of moments, early on, I was finding myself double thinking everything, trying to make sure everything was perfect, or, you know, if I understood everything. A lot of times I was realizing that, you know, if I was just remaining me, just being instinctive in certain moments, and, you know, the first thing that comes to your mind creatively, if I could meld that with the knowledge of the game and the ins and outs and the small tinkerings of things, and understanding camera and understanding lighting and how they can apply to how you want to use it, if I could meld those two things together, I can think of a great shot on instinct, and then I also knew how to execute those same ideas, then I would be able to feel that comfort in what I was doing, you know, being around so many people once getting into the industry that were just, you know, fantastic and brilliant and light years ahead of me. You know, I needed something to hold that comfort. So being able to instinctively say, oh, maybe, you know, I have an idea for this shot, or I just have an idea in general. If I knew that I had enough time to gain that knowledge to where I can tap both of those together and I can know how to exactly create that in front of camera, because, you know, when I was a kid and those instincts kicked in, it just took, you know, me and my pen or me and my paintbrush. Whereas now, you know, you have an idea and I have to look over to those nine people that's, you know, in the camera crew and the camera, you know, relay that and translate that same idea, and then look to my left and, you know, my grip and my gaffers are over there, you know, getting ready and seeing, you know, what's going on. And I have to see, you know, what lights I have to tell this very specific story. If I have that idea and I know that, hey, you know, this specific light can do that, or I have trust enough to ask my gaffer, you know, for a specific thing that can translate to them being able to help portray that idea, then it gave me, you know, even more comfort in that, you know. And even now I'm still discovering myself and building how exactly that painting looks, you know, on camera. But those little simple things and the command of it gave me a lot more confidence to be able to go with my instincts and feel as though that I am, you know, a cinematographer or a filmmaker, because it can be very, very hard.
Yeah, well, let's dive into the feature film that you worked on, The Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul. You have worked with Anthony Richmond, the DP, the famous DP who shot The Beatles, among various other projects. How lessons that you learned at film school and in your life were useful during that experience? And what did you learn on that set?
Wow, yeah. That was, at that point in time, I had been on a few solid-sized sets while I was living in California, post-film school, with a lot of people around the area and jobs that you get. But at that very moment, that was something that was kind of like a gift in the making. I guess to get to a somewhat of a backstory behind it, Anthony Richmond, who was the cinematographer on that film that you were mentioning, he's our chair, the lead, you know, in our cinematography department at New York Film Academy. After a while of the whole year just bugging his mind and really talking to him and learning a lot from him, mostly because, you know, as a kid growing up, I was a baseball kid, and saying a lot it's a staple, you know, for baseball kids. And lo and behold, as I got older and met him, I realized he was a cinematographer on that film, you know. And you know, who would have known that would have lined up that what I wanted to be for the rest of my life, and one of my favorite films, and something that was pivotal in me growing up as a human being, as a child, would be, you know, shot by the same person who would teach me cinematography, this art, with all that knowledge, and also be the same person who would walk up to me and say, hey, you know, I have this feature I'm shooting in Atlanta, Georgia, would you want to come with me? You know, and it was mostly just as a shadow, but it was like it was a brilliant opportunity. I'd never, you know, I think the budget on that film was maybe like 40 to 50 million, maybe even more. But to just see those cogs and everything moving at that level and that speed was just brilliant. At the same time, giving all the credit to Tony, knowing that, you know, maybe this may not be the exact film you want to go on and go forth, or this specific genre, but there's elements and there's things here that you can gain knowledge while being here. And as I was saying before, a lot of things that I, you know, that I learned from him, but as myself growing up, is just that you can learn so that those instincts, when they come in, you know, maybe it might not be, you know, what you're shooting may not be a kid, you know, running around with his parents, you know, in his parents' caravan, you know, having fun and adventure, but, you know, how the camera moves specifically, or, you know, being able to place a camera within the vehicle and having the knowledge of what you need to do that, and understanding certain angles, you know, regardless of the subject matter, is something that you need to know as a cinematographer, and getting an opportunity to meet everyone on that crew who has so many experiences on the list of films that you can go through that you're a fan of, you know. So that opportunity of not only literally watching, you know, one of my favorite cinematographers and someone who, you know, you subconsciously growing up falling in love with actually watching them do the work, you know, kind of going back to the basketball analogy. It's kind of like, you know, walking into a gym and watching Michael Jordan, you know, shoot the basketball. It's like, wow, man, I'm here, you know, this human being who, like you said, you know, Men of Honor, Sandlot, you know, so many great films, and I'm standing here side by side with him, and any question I could ask, you know, he, you know, it was just go, just ask, you know, and it's one of the best experiences of my life because it gave me a lot of guidance and confidence even more when I left there and going into shooting my own films.
Is there a particular moment from that set that you can remember that was fun or like weird or was a revelation to you? Anything at all?
On the first few days, because there's so many people, uh-huh. You know, I think the first day there was like, you know, walking up, pulling up on set, and, you know, you see 150 people outside, you're like, whoa. You know, like I'm sifting through people to find Tony himself. But as the days go on and we're at this, with this restaurant that they turn into this kids like play place, and there's kids everywhere screaming. There's crew members everywhere that's going crazy because there's kids screaming everywhere, and they're shooting a scene in this little ball pen that these like 20 some odd kids are in, and there's, you know, the camera operators are moving around. And I think what settled my mind in, not only to that at the end of the day, when it's said and done, all of it's filmmaking, but it's also became less intimidating of having that command as a cinematographer, because, you know, as things are going on, Tony turns around, he's like, where's the C camera, mate? You know, and the camera wasn't out, we weren't really using it, and, you know, they grabbed it for him, he took it, and, you know, he's knee deep in playpen balls with these kids running around, and he's, you know, operating the camera itself, getting shots too, and it's nothing fancy, and he's just doing it to get more shots, to get variations of it. And as I'm watching him, you know, Tony's at that point in time, Tony's almost an 80-year-old man, you know, but to see him in the action, in the work, and to see it not as this big mystery as we all can tend to see it, and it still is that, you know, it's a mystery how some of these films look and the things that people can come up with. But to see your mentor, who, you know, is a spry 80-year-old man, literally in there in a ball pit with these chaotic kids going around, and he's getting these shots, and he's just smiling ear to ear because he loves it. You know, that kind of demystified everything for me, and it made me trust those instincts even more. You know, I'm like, if it's that simple, if it's, you know, if none of that stuff was storyboarded, you know, none of that stuff was in the script, but it's those instincts to add those things to it, and also just have that ability to say, you know what, man, you know, if I'm 80 and, you know, I can go hop in here and one of these kids could knock me over, and that, you know, that could be it. But no, he's in there. It's the adventure, and I'm 100% sure, and especially from the stories that he's told me, you know, through his career and things that he, you know, that he did do, you know, across so many films that we've seen, and the risks that he did take, you know, like I'm witnessing what was someone who at my age was doing that same thing, but he was with the Beatles, or he was with David Bowie, or, you know, he was, you know, shooting, you know, Men of Honor, like, you know, he was taking those same risks, you know, and going out and getting it, man. And it just gave me even more and more confidence to do it, because cinematography in that very specific position is a very hard thing to learn and a hard thing to apply. So, you know, so before applying it and really, you know, considering yourself to be a cinematographer, I think there's a lot to learn and a lot of experience to gain. And I really appreciate him for collectively putting all of that almost in one big opportunity for me that really, you know, set me off and going forward. Because after that, you know, I ended up, you know, post then I've shot maybe 4 features, I think, at this point in time, you know, and they're nothing at that level just yet. But, you know, that confidence means a lot when you're a cinematographer. Confidence is key.
Were there any perks or bonuses you got from working on that movie after everything was over?
Oh, yeah. I got a really nice water bottle that I held on to. That's a joke. I made a lot of contacts from that shoot, from a lot of people that still work in the film industry. I had a big opportunity to work a few union gigs post that. I got to learn a lot about camera and camera assisting from a young man who, he's about 60-year-old man, but his name is Emil Hampton, and he was a camera assistant on so many films, and his biggest film, I think, that anyone would recognize, he was a camera assistant on the Titanic, you know.
Oh, wow.
So that opportunity to get, you know, to work on another feature and to, you know, at a different capacity, but to learn from another human being who, you know, that's a pretty big thing, you know, and I would have never known that, you know, someone who looks like me was a camera assistant on such a huge, huge film, you know, at that point in time, that wasn't a thing I could really fathom. And getting to know him and understanding him and him teaching me how to navigate the industry and how to become you. And it was a lot of things that, you know, I felt that I was getting from Tony, but from, you know, another human being in another position that, as a cinematographer, you really have to know and understand and appreciate your camera assistant, you know. So to be able to get that time with someone who has done it and is someone who's on that ultimate level was even more in that level of appreciation for crew and what they can bring to you, you know, and for those experiences. That was another thing that kind of really was a plus from that experience with Tony on that film.
How do you build your crew? Like when it comes to making a movie, how do you build your cinematography department, so to speak?
It's fairly simple. A lot of times it's the second you realize or inform what size crew you'll have or what you'll be capable of doing, then you can kind of judge with, you know, who you choose for your crew. A lot of times once you know, it can be one person, it could go from one person to eight to 20, depending on the size. And, you know, at that point in time, once you know, you can either, you know, you can make calls and see who's available. Or for me, I kind of assess, you know, who's who does what best. And then I'll call everybody, but I kind of want to at least have a guide to, like, you know, if I pair up, you know, this person with this person on this camera, this will definitely meld better because they're super fast, they're super ready, you know, they're always on the go. And this person, no matter what the circumstances is, you know, they're really great at pulling focus during extreme circumstances. And I know, okay, I have a film with a ton of handheld and it's going to be flying around, that I know maybe they might be better for it. But, you know, I could call everybody I know and they may not be available, and then you kind of have to select by that, but always selecting who you know would be best fit for the job, not only with who they are and their abilities, but their natural abilities to pick up on what you're trying to translate and bring to life within the film. You know, you might have two or three friends that are, or people that you know that are gaffers, you know, and you're going into a sci-fi film. Well, you know, maybe one of them has the experience, but maybe this sci-fi film might be shot a bit differently than your normal sci-fi film. Maybe it might be more dramatic. And so maybe looking over towards Edgar and saying, hey, Edgar, would you mind, you know, and then picking up on that. So it's an easy process, but it's not really that easy. But I would say it's easy because if you're a cinematographer, you really pick up on those things first, especially with people who you work with so much. But you kind of can pick up on those things with people you've never met before, and you know, you're meeting them for one time, or you've seen their work and you just want to work with them. You can always pick up on the synergy or someone's abilities or their creative eye, depending on exactly what it is that you're shooting and creating.
How do you search for cinematography gigs? What is the process finding new projects to work on? Where do you find them? Do you use any particular online tools, or What are your methods?
I'm really selective about the gigs I choose at this point in time, which I feel like, you know, is a good thing. One way, well, my best friend who's a director, he, you know, I would say once every two or three years, he gets an idea. And, you know, because we're so close, because we're best friends, our route with that is just kind of getting together and creating it right then and there without any extra avenues or anything or such. But as a cinematographer, you know, away from those situations, one of the main sources I use is a website called Mandy.com. That's a pretty huge help for that a lot of filmmakers use. A lot of times you can pick up on some really, really, really interesting gigs there. You know, there can be global, can be right here in DC, can be in New York, can be close. And you get to see what, you know, you get to have a preview of what the person is shooting so you can understand. And you can be selective with what you want to apply to. And, you know, that just like any job, that doesn't, you know, make you perfect for anything or qualify you for everything. But, you know, I think that's a good method. I've picked up on a few cinematography gigs that I really enjoyed through that process and met a lot of people on sets through that website. and other than that, for the most part, a few film groups that I'm a part of on like Facebook and like Instagram and such, as well as I also freelance for a company called Condé Nast. I do a lot of cinematography through that company for brands like Vogue and Bon Appetit magazine and things like that. So those are kind of like the few ways I you know, dart in and out of, you know, doors to find cinematography gigs. Yeah.
Nice. So let's chat a little bit about failures. Is there a particular failure that you'd like to share and that later turned into some form of success?
I don't think there's ever really any or a big failure I can recall. But I will say to that point, I grew up a person that did not fear failure because I was kind of the person that enjoyed being in high pressure situations or bigger situations. I didn't mind it. When I played sports, I was never remotely the best person on the field or even the hardest worker, but being in those moments, you know, I've been on baseball fields with people who play in the majors now, football field with people who play, you know, in the big leagues now, or, you know, once I got started in this industry, you know, I was on the other side of a bunch of red carpets of any and all the greatest actors and celebrities you can find. And, you know, I noticed that I never really got nervous in anything, you know, or, you know, and I always understood that I was never the best at anything. I picked up on things decently, but I always needed time with everything I needed to learn. And for me, the only thing that could really help control that time was understanding failure. I'm saying, you know, I'm going to go here and there's going to be a moment where the light is in the wrong spot, or there's going to be a moment here where, you know, I drew up a storyboard and it just didn't fit, or, you know, anything in that manner as you were learning this process, or, you know, putting a tape marker down in the wrong spot, or, you know, maybe making a mistake with the media that goes in and out of camera and you lose a clip or two like that. You know, knowing and understanding that, you know, hey, man, I have plenty of friends and people, plenty of people that I work with that are, you know, machines when it comes to filmmaking or art or anything, you know. And even growing up, I just, you know, everything I needed to do was time-based, you know, with, you know, it would take the average person, you know, a minute or two, but, you know, if it took Jeremy an hour or two, sometimes it might be necessary to take that time. And in that process, trying it and testing it and getting those experiments out, saying, hey, you know, I could fall flat on my face, but, you know, I've always been the kind of person that you can see me smile while I'm flat on my face, you know, so that's fine. I can get up and try again. And that second or third time, I understand what mistake I made or what that failure was, and going back and fixing it, because I know there's a long haul and a long process to everything that's worth it, especially, you know, so not being afraid to fail and getting that sense of failing and, you know, the world not falling or crashing behind you, you know, literally, you know, makes you understand, all right, that's fine. That's fine. If I take two steps back here, I know that it'll help me take four steps forward later. So I was fine with those two steps back, you know, taking two steps back while everyone else was already, you know, they'd already jumped out the blocks. They were already going, you know, I can take those two steps back, think about it a second, and it would buy me time to catch up and be, you know, where I want to be or who I want to be or, you know, in whatever manner you would have.
These are some good pieces of wisdom I'm gonna apply in my life now. That's pretty good. Deep cuts. Yeah. So let's talk about Barbie versus Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
So what do you think? What are your predictions? Are you going on a double feature? Tell me everything.
Yes, yes. I'm definitely going on a double feature. I have tickets already to see Oppenheimer at the Lincoln Square with a good friend of mine who I actually just shot a feature with in December. We're going to go see it in Lowe's Lincoln Square. Big old beautiful IMAX, but right
true before IMAX.
I'm going to see. Yeah, true act. And it was before, but we changed tickets, so that it's so crazy. Like the tickets sell out so fast, especially in that theater. So we got a 10:30 showing, but I'm going to see Barbie later on that night, which I am extremely excited for as well. Like those combinations of films, I haven't been excited for like a combination of back-to-back films like that, especially on the same day. That's amazing, man. I'm so excited. I love theater experiences, and Christopher Nolan definitely always gives me just the best theater experiences. And Greta Gerwig, I always love her story. Like, she's a huge motivation for me, especially in her first film, Frances Ha. And when it comes to like the cinematography of that film, that was kind of one of my biggest inspirations for one of the early features I shot, it being like a black and white, simple mumblecore film with that essence of it. And just watching her go forth and go forward now and see her take on something like this that has like the entire world going crazy for it. So I'm super excited. So, so excited.
Which movie you think will succeed in box office more?
Oh, man. I'm going to say Barbie because I think Christopher Nolan makes some of the biggest, most beautiful films, and there's big, big names in that film. But there's like huge, huge names in Barbie, and then the fact that it's Barbie, like, you know, that's. Yeah. Like the buzz for it, even for kids that can't remotely watch the movie, it's like huge. So I think just from the fact that it's Barbie is going to make like a lot of money. It's going to be a really big success. I mean, you also have, you know, you got everyone that's in it, but it's led by Ryan Gosling and Margot Robbie. I think everyone loves those two. So it's going to be, you know, gonna be huge.
Yeah. It's the whole phenomenon right now. All the girls dressing up and going to the premiere like this. Like, my wife will gonna go in a dress with her girlfriends to watch the premiere while I'll be watching Oppenheimer in the same theater. Yeah, that will be a fun experience. I plan to watch Oppenheimer probably twice. First time I'm watching it in Dolby Cinema because I love Dolby Cinema. I love the quality of the image. And second time, I'm going to watch it in true IMAX and Universal City Walk because it has the big IMAX, yeah.
I love that place. That's one of the best theaters in the world. I love that theater.
Nice, yeah. So let's talk about feature films versus TV shows. Which one do you think is better as a job, let's say as a cinematographer, and what do you think is the future of both?
I would say you probably make more consistent money off of TV shows as a cinematographer. I think you may have a lot more command. I think on television, for me personally, I love television, but I'm a It's something about going to the movies and seeing your favorite movie up on that screen that connected me to cinematography in a different way. Like being able to create those images that you see on that Dolby Cinema screen, you know, it's like, it's something that, you know, it changes me, whether or not it could be a Star Wars film or it could be Moonlight, you know, seeing it up there is something, it's a totally different experience for me. So it's kind of hard to choose. Yeah, I think you can have success at both. I think you maybe depending on what you're shooting, you'd have more artistic reign on a feature. And you know, everything is time pressured in this industry. But I feel like you would have a lot more restraints and a lot less time on your hands as a cinematographer in the television world. A lot of things have to be really, 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 really quick. So, but you know, but they are really merging together now. You know, like not even now. You know, I would say like maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, there's like a, well, even earlier than that, there's an advent of a lot of television shows that started to feel and look and be shot just like films. You could take them and just put them up in the theater, and that's kind of what people are doing now. You know, you have your favorite shows and just go buy a nice big old TV, nice, you know, nice surround sound speakers, and you know, and you're right there. And you see it now with every single show, almost every single show now is just shot so yeah. beautifully. Now you can rarely find just a simple show that's just up on, you know, on television. Everything is shot so beautifully now.
What are your thoughts on Apple Vision Pro, the new headset from Apple? Do you think it will replace movie theaters if it's as good as they promote it to be?
That's a hard one to answer. Replace completely? I think it'll have, if it works, if it really, really works and it gives us a different experience as human beings, that we can really actually say, wow, this is the new experience and this is the way to go. This is the innovation that, you know, we got right. I hope it doesn't. But it's also, even through COVID, we saw, you know, and the changes in advancement of TV, you see how much easier it is to stay home and almost get that same exact entertainment. And if this is anything close to what it can possibly be, then, you know, you could stand in the middle of the street, or you can stand in a movie theater with 400 people, and with those things on, you really, the experience is out of this world. So Brandon wouldn't replace it, but I think it would probably hurt the theater industry, because it'd be another avenue of keeping everyone at home or wherever they are respectively and not in the theater.
Yeah, I think it also, if it works as they say, there will be more demand for good feature films, you know, kind of like back in the days, because right now it seems like all theater movies are like Barbie versus Oppenheimer, and all other films like Past Lives, for example, I watched recently with my wife. It wasn't theaters, but I don't think a lot of people went to watch it in theater. That's the thing. But this thing may allow to watch those films in theater like experience, because they have kind of like surround sound. They have, you can stretch your screen in front of you. So that could be a good side of it, I guess. But until everyone is able to afford it, it probably will take at least 5 or 10 years. Because they predict it's going to be around $3,500 per headset. And every single person needs to have it. Individual experience, yeah.
Yeah, but if it works, then yeah, everyone will be... Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And probably you can combine them with other people. Like, for example, we can, like you and Marilyn, I'm here, and we can go watch a movie together in a theater-like environment via our headsets, you know? Or even this phone call could be like a VR experience in and of itself.
Yeah.
That's crazy when you start thinking about the possibilities. The possibilities.
Yeah. Things are changing really fast, man. It's interesting to see.
Yeah, life. The world moved on.
Yeah.
So this is the question that I ask my guests towards the end of the interview. If you're an extraterrestrial from a perfect world, when Everything is beautiful and organized. And now you're visiting our world with all of its issues and problems and everything in between. What would be one thing that you'd fix, that you'd focus on fixing?
Wow. That's a... You're asking me, like, what's the key to life or something like that? What's the meaning of life?
I don't ask you to fix everything. I just ask what would be the one thing that you would be most interested in fixing. And you don't need to know the how you're going to do it. Yeah. What else?
I guess not to go, you know, to get too deep or, you know, to go too strong at anything. But I mean, I would say, you know, I think for me, in my experience in life, when people or human beings are around each other, when there's a level of respect for no matter who's in the area, no matter who's near you, when there's an equal level of respect for everyone, everything seems to run smoothly. There's no issues, you know, in any room I've ever been in, any you know, program or anything I participated in, you know, when it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people around and you can look at that person to your left, you can look at that person to your right and understand what they're doing here, understand the situation, or understand that you're just simply about to do something together, everything goes smoothly, you know. So I think, you know, if I came here as you know, an extraterrestrial with a, you know, big bulbous finger and a bag of Reese's Pieces in my back pocket, I think I would, you know, say, hey, everybody, let's just, you know, just understand and respect each other. And that's the key right there.
Beautiful. So is there anything else that you'd like to add? Could be anything at all. Like to share where people can find you?
I have to do a lot better with the world in social media. Kind of like somewhat of a closing person with that, and not really an extrovert at all. I'm super introverted, especially getting older now. I would say, I'm going to do better with that stuff, but my Instagram is my full name, Jeremy Martin Harris. And I should actually have my full cinematography website going once this one particular film that I have that's in post-production, I really can't, you know, put out into the world until it's finished. But, you know, people see that and on there. And, you know, I would just say, look out for more work of mine. And I'm, you know, excited to continue to grow and take on even bigger projects in this world of cinematography that I fell in love with. And more importantly, making some of the best films with one of my closest friends, wink, wink, wink. I love making films with them. So I'm sure that'll be very, very soon, and that'll definitely hit a nice little satisfaction meter for a filmmaker once that comes together.
Nice. All right. And now we arrive at the final question of Rumi K Talks, and this is Obsession of the Week. For example, it could be anything. It could be your favorite pizza, your favorite movie, or anything in between. My obsession of the week, for example, is plants. And I'm obsessed with house plants. I even start naming them. And there's this app, Planta, which I use to keep track when you need to water them or like repot or do like other things. And for example, I just got a notification, water Shakira. Shakira is one of my plants. It really became like a serious obsession this week. So what is your obsession?
Oh man, topical I guess between us, but anytime we draw near to a film that there's a cinematographer that I really love or a cinematographer and director collaboration that I really love is coming out, and Hoyte van Hoytema and Chris Nolan with Oppenheimer is, you know, I love that work between the two of them. So I would say I've been on Shot Deck a lot this week, just looking over their work on past things. And I rewatched Interstellar. 2 days ago. So yeah, my obsession of the week is definitely going to be like a lot of research into the cinematography of Oppenheimer, even deeper into, you know, what's already been said, and even deeper into, you know, because everyone knows about the IMAX and all that, but like, you know, as a cinematographer, like what lenses they shot on, how they shot, you know, select they shot, and actually hearing, you know, from the cinematographer and all that stuff before the film happens and all that lead up, man. I'm gonna just be like a 3-year-old and a kid in the theater once it starts.
Yeah. And this episode will air on July 21st, so when I'm going to watch Oppenheimer.
Nice. So I get to watch this. I'm going on the 22nd. 22nd or 23rd, yeah.
That's like Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah. So it's going to be like everyone's going to be there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much, Jeremy, for coming today to chat with me.
Thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Rumiké Talks podcast. You can find the show notes at rumiké.com. I'm your host, Konstantin Staraletsky. My producing partner, Rumena Dinevska. See ya.